Someone You Should Know. A program about people you know, and even more that you don't. Hosted by Stuart Sachs, veteran, husband, father, and grandfather. Now, here's your host, Stuart Sachs.
Well, welcome to another edition of Someone You Should Know. I'm certainly happy to have you with us as we head into May. Can you believe almost half of this year is gone? It's flying by too fast. But one thing's for sure, we're going to be here every week with very, very interesting and exciting guests to share their stories with us. And today is no exception. And we are brought to you today by our good friends over at No Sweat Expert Heating and Air Conditioning. You know, I've told you every time that we sponsor, mention this sponsor, they go out of their way. They offer four visits a year rather than the traditional two. We are now heading into our summer season. You want to make sure that air conditioner is running because you don't want to get stuck with the heat and not have air conditioning. Give them a call. No Sweat Experts, good people taking good care of you. Well, I want to welcome to the show Scott Graham. And Scott if you stretch your arm out and list all of the things that Scott does, you're going to have to take the other arm and list a bunch more on the other arm. I have absolutely no idea how one man can fit so many different things into his life, but you do it.
It's a challenge, and there are people in my life that are always telling me, oh, you should do less. And I just ignore them and continue to embrace one of the things that's sadly or greatly true about this is that I, you know, experience failure a lot because I'm doing so many things that something is going to fall apart at some point during the week, and I'm not going to be able to catch up to it.
Bound to stumble over something once in a while.
Absolutely.
But it's not just a series of things that you're involved in that are related, because most of them are totally unrelated.
That is true.
I mean, the typical ones that stood out to me when I started gathering information was that you're an instructor, but not an instructor of just one thing. You're an instructor of everything from meditation to firefighting.
That is, yes. Tai Chi, EMS. I'm all over there.
So, you know, I guess the best way to start is to start kind of at the beginning. And when you were younger, what did you decide you really wanted to do with your life? And what did you start pursuing before you went off on all these tangents?
Oh, see, that's the trouble, is that I've always been on all these tangents all the time. That's the trouble. In fact, I graduated from high school early. So I started school when I started college when I was 17 and was kind of on the fast track, and I languished in college, not because I struggled in subjects. I languished in college because I loved everything. And I went to summer school. My parents were like, we don't know what the hell he's doing. After I'd been in school for like undergraduate school for 7 years, my parents were like, I was going to school in the summer because I was taking classes. I changed my majors. I did this. I did that. I was all over the place. What made me graduate, I have to tell you, is that the school came and that my advisor said, you really need to make a decision and do something. Because if you don't graduate in the next 6 months, you're going to have to spend another 2 years here because we now have a foreign language requirement. And that will mean that you'll be in undergraduate school for like 11 years or something like that. I had so many credits when I graduated college, undergraduate work. They gave me two bachelor's degrees. Two.
Really?
Yeah, because I had so many. It wasn't a double major. Just because it wasn't like I had, you know, I majored in psychology and minored in computer engineering for one degree, and my other degree was communication and minored in music.
Well, they're all related, of course.
They're all related. Yeah, they're all kind of related. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say they came to you and they said they really would like for you to graduate because they need to make room for another student.
I'm sure that was part of it.
My to get an education.
Were so they were like, oh, thank God.
So okay. When you finally, you know, graduated with these two degrees and two majors and two minors and everything, what'd you first do? What was the first career?
I hiked the Appalachian Trail.
Oh, okay. Which, you know, it seems funny, but I don't think people really understand how many kids graduate from college and the first thing they do is go backpack in Europe or something. Well,
you know, part of it was that, you know, I'd been studying so hard and so focused on stuff that it was just nice to get away and go hiking. And so I went hiking for 1,800 miles.
Now, were you athletic in high school and in college?
Not particularly, but I did like to spend time in the woods, and I enjoyed going hiking and going for walks in the woods with my dad. And so it was just a hop, skip, and a jump to go backpacking and hiking, and that's how I ended up moving to New England, because the Outward Bound was looking for somebody that had a very specific mix of two diverse skill sets. And they couldn't find many people that had like counseling experience and outdoor experience. And so I fit that bill. And so then I ended up coming up here and working for Outward Bound for many years.
All right. Now, when you say up here, where are we talking?
Vermont, New England, New Hampshire, this area.
So you pretty much spent most of your adult life in that area?
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel very much like it's almost like I've always been a New Englander. I know that there's people in New England or in New England who's like, ah, baloney.
Right. Yeah. No! Nor'easters, you know, snow up to your chin, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But you, and it's amazing to me. If it's snowing, what the hell? You'll go for a walk.
And absolutely. And I was from, and I grew up in Florida. And so it was a man, you know, I have to tell you, when I first came to New England, I started working for Outward Bound. I was like really nervous. Cause I'm like, I don't know. I've never been in snow. They did one of the things that Outward Bound does is they want to make sure that your comfort zone and your ability to feel okay is like much broader than what's going on with the students. So that if you're hiking someplace and like the shit hits the fan and the students are freaking out, you're like, it's old hat basically for you. And so they had a winter staff training they signed me up for. And so I went to do the winter staff training. And one of the things that they do in Outward Bound is they do this activity called the run and dip. They do it in all their courses, you know, in the summertime. They go running for like, you know, a couple miles, and then everybody puts on their swimming suit and a life jacket and jumps in the Atlantic or jumps into a pond. And they do that every day as part of their physical regimen. So during this winter staff training, they said, we're going to be doing a run and dip on Saturday. And everybody thought they were joking. And we woke up at sad. I'll never forget this. Oh my gosh. It's like surreal. We woke up and they said, we're going running. And people were like, we're not going to do a run and dip. It was 6 degrees below zero. 6 degrees. There were guys there. I remember seeing these guys with beards like yours, and their beards were crusted with from their
bicycles.
And so we went on. It was only a short, like 2-3 mile run. We came back, we came up this little path, and they had taken a sledgehammer and sledgehammered a big hole in the ice, and they put some Ensolite pads around it so you didn't slip. And the cook was there dressed in a Hawaiian shirt and Hawaiian shorts on a lounge chair, and they were playing reggae music really loud. And we just came up to this piece. Nobody said anything. Everybody took off all of their clothes, and you jumped into this little hole at 6 degrees below zero, got up, put your shoes on, and then ran naked a quarter of a mile to the shower house to get warmed up. It was crazy.
And you call that fun?
I have to tell you though, wait, there's a big like, you know, moral to the story. So the very first course that I was on, which was just literally 2 weeks later, in December, we were going up this trail called the Black Angel Trail in the White Mountains, and we're stepping on these rocks to go across this stream, and this one student slipped. And when he slipped, he grabbed me. Now, we are like miles and miles and miles and miles from help. And it's really cold. And he grabbed me, and we both fell into the water. And because I had done that training, like, I knew I'm not screwing around here. This right. is not something to screw around when you're miles and miles and miles. Two other instructors were there. They were trying to get him to take off his clothes. He was all upset. He was crying. He was like, I'm not taking my clothes off. I mean, I was naked in like 15 seconds. And there was another instructor with me. And I'm like, give me this clothes. I mean, I was totally dry in a minute, except for my boots, which, you know, yep. I put some plastic bags on and got through the day and things got dried. But if it wasn't for that experience of knowing this is not something you want to screw around with, yeah. I would have been just like that student, wailing and crying and doing whatever. But I knew this is focused and do this. And so it was a good thing after all.
We maybe lose sight of the fact that what all this adds up to is survival skills. Being able to do that and know what to do in those cases.
And isn't that true about every single thing in our life, right? You're married to someone, and if you're married to someone and the shit hasn't hit the fan yet, it's coming.
Right.
It's coming. You're going to fall in. It's going to be a mess. You have to have those survival skills and strip down and get warm again and continue on. And it's the same thing with work and school and your parents, and you name it. It all comes down to having this tenacity and being aware that you have to do things in the face of adversity so that you can get through it.
Now, this program, what was the name of the program?
This was an Outward Bound. This was called Outward Bound. So it's Hurricane Island Outward Bound School. There's Outward Bound schools all over the world.
I was just going to say that's a program that people were, you know, that are watching and listening this show from anywhere in the country, they may be able to reach out and find an Outward Bound program that they can get involved in.
Absolutely. You can do it as short as 3 days and as long as a semester. And you can go with just kids. If you got kids, you can go with just adults. You can go with just women's. They have a program just for vets. It goes on and on.
That's a great program. We'll have to check that out. Now, we just started scrolling your website across the screen and all. Is there information about that program on your website?
There isn't. Just information. Well, there's a little piece about me. There's a little video when I was an Outward Bound instructor helping somebody get up one of these. What was it? It's like an hourglass shaped tower that's like made of telephone poles. And this person was struggling to get up that hourglass shaped tower. And I went up there and helped her to achieve the top. What are we looking at here?
There you go. There's Outward Bound. Yeah. So it looks like the heaviest concentration are in the Northeast.
Yes, there's a few. There's New York City Outward Bound School. There's North Carolina Outward Bound School.
All the way down to the Smoky Mountains.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great program.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I had done an Outward Bound course when I was a kid in college during one of those summers.
That sounds
weird. And I interestingly enough, that experience has set the trajectory for my entire life.
And in the statistics that I've read about you, you have spent over 1,600 nights out sleeping outside
on the ground. I was with a buddy yesterday. I just got a camper a couple years ago when COVID hit and everyone's buying campers. And he said to me, he goes, I don't know, 1,600 nights in a camper. And I'm like, no, I just got the damn camper. I earned my stripes sleeping on the ground in the wintertime.
the first video that I saw with you, you had the dogs out on the side of a lake. You had a fire going, and you were wrapped up in blankets.
That was last week. It was 26 degrees out last week.
Yeah. And most people would say, I'm going to go inside and light the fireplace. You go outside and build a fire and just sit there and look at Mother Nature from an easy chair.
Right. Right.
And you love it.
Yeah. That was actually the shakedown trip. I have two dogs, a big black lab and a Jack Russell Terrorist. And I have a big chair that I mean, they go with these dogs have been with me everywhere. I would be lost without these dogs. And I just invested in, and I think it came today, it's like an outdoor couch so that it's, or an outdoor love seat so that I can sit in it and the little Jack Russell can sit in it and the big black lab doesn't have to sit there longingly looking at me, trying to get on my lap on this little chair. Right. We can all get on the little love seat together. So you got to take care of those little animals that give you so much love.
Well, and speaking of animals, not only are you involved in what we've talked about so far, but also you're very, very actively involved in animal rescue.
I am. So my husband of 31 years and I had started kind of an animal rescue as a hobby, and it was really his passion. It was his passion to save animals and do that stuff. I mean, I had a dog when I was a little kid. That was it. And then I had fish in a fish tank, and now I'm surrounded by sheep and llamas and pigs and donkeys and peacocks and rooster. I mean, the list goes on. And so when he died a couple of years ago, right before the COVID pandemic hit and he died, one of the first things I did was take the rescue from like this hobby piece that I knew I could not sustain on my own to a full formal not-for-profit, working to get volunteers and other people that have really helped sustain Brian's vision moving forward so that it's not just on me. It's not where I want it to be. It's because if something happened to me, it would all go down the tubes. And so I know that, right? And I'm not going to let that happen. I'm taking those steps so that if something happens to me, this is going to be here, 100 years from now. That's important.
But
you want that.
First of all, my condolences on the loss of your partner and all. I know that can be a very, very traumatic experience in itself. But to keep up this rescue in his memory and honor, I think that's admirable. And the name of that rescue is Willoughby.
There it is, right there on Facebook. Yep. Everybody all eats together. Everybody all hangs out together.
And all those animals get along with each other?
Absolutely.
That's
if only people could be that way.
That's a Facebook page, folks. So if you want to go to Willoughby Rescue and look and see what they're doing, or you're so motivated to drop a donation their way, please do so. And make sure you say you heard about Willoughby Rescue and Scott Graham on the Someone You Should Know show. Well, that is a cool website. I've got to go visit that page. Llamas.
Yeah. Alpacas, actually.
Oh, so, alpaca. Okay.
But people get them confused. They kind of look the same, but they, yeah. You know, alpacas were this, I don't want to say it was a scam, although I just did, didn't I? I don't want to say it was like a multi-level marketing thing, although I just did, didn't I? Yeah. But it was this little racket that people created, and everybody got an alpaca that was there. And in fact, they had come up with something. They lobbied the government so that people could write off huge amounts of money for their alpaca farms. And all these people got alpacas. And the thing with alpacas is that they only give good fleece for a short period of time. And then it's not really great anymore. So then you're stuck with an old alpaca that nobody wants. So these people are like, what do we do? And so they end up getting rescued because the bottom fell out.
Okay. Yeah. It's something like bunny rabbits at Easter.
Exactly. Or, you know, when they had the 101 Dalmatians, everybody was buying a Dalmatian. There was the whole pot-bellied pig craze. Everybody was doing that. And the only people that made money were the people that had the first pot-bellied pig, you know, or the first alpaca. And then they, you know, you have to get a genuine alpaca that's from this lineage. And
So, you know, I want to ask you about something else that you know, now that you've rattled off and mouthed off for all of this time, now I want to start to talk a little bit about silence, because you also believe in meditation, and you have spent multiple days in meditation. Now, are those just a day here, a day there, or whatever, or is this a lengthy period of time?
Lengthy 10 to 12 days at a time. And I've done probably about 260 days of silence. I know. It's hard to believe.
It is hard to believe. And what is the preparation process to put yourself into this meditative state for that period of time?
You just go. You just go and the one place that I have been going to more consistently than any place else, you just leave the driving to them. They've, you know, been doing courses, hundreds of thousands of courses over the years, all over the world. And they have it down pat. So you just go in and, you know, day one, they get you oriented, you get some food, and then you follow their little program for 10 days. And on the 11th day or 12th day, you're done.
And how many people are in the program at the same time?
Oh, it depends on the center that you go to. There's a center in Texas, actually. They're all over the United States. And the one that I've been going to in Massachusetts, which is actually the very first center that was formed in the United States, houses about 200 people at once.
Wow.
That's a lot of people not talking.
Yeah. Maybe I should go there with my wife.
I had a friend that I would go there with, and they work on really keeping people segregated. So there's no communication, and people are like, how can you do that? It's actually really easy when everybody is working at not talking. And it's actually really easy when the vast majority of people won't even look at you in the eye. And so you'll see someone who has done many courses like myself, and two people will be walking towards the door, and one, you know, there's going to be a gesture that's going to be necessary. Are you going to bump into each other? And so usually one of those people will just turn and stand to the side, so that you're not even having to go after you or a wink or nod or any of that stuff.
It, So what is the purpose of this, Scott? Is it to be introspective and just be within yourself in a calm way and let your mind take over from what your body would experience?
No, not at all. That's a really good question. You know, most people have this really warped view of what meditation is. They think that meditation is like getting high, right? You're going to go someplace. You're going to be on some other realm. You're very stressed out, had a really hard day, go home. I'm hip. I'm cool. You know, it's like, should I meditate or should I have a Cosmopolitan? Should I meditate or should I smoke some dope? I don't know. Maybe I'll smoke some dope and meditate. Not that way at all. Not really. I mean, the real purpose of meditation is like a better analogy. And I can say this because I'm also a personal trainer. It's like running. People don't run. Well, some people do. People don't run because they enjoy it. Most people run because running creates a benefit at some other aspect of their life. They're overweight. They're going to lose weight. They have high blood pressure. The blood pressure is going to be lower. They get winded going up and down the stairs. Now they're not getting winded because they're doing this exercise 3 times a week, 4 times a week. They go to the gym, they lift weights because that has a benefit in another part of your life. And true meditation is like fitness for your mind. And it has a benefit in that other part of your life. And so one of the things that you first focus on, and I know that you know this, and I know your listeners and viewers know this too. You just know that you have this crazy voice in your head. Absolutely freaking crazy. Tells you all kinds of shit, all kinds of crap, all kinds of stupid stuff. You let that voice say things to you. I bet this is true. You let that voice say things to you that you would not let another damn person on this planet say to you. You let that voice say things to you that you wouldn't put up with from anybody. And so part of the training is actually pushing that voice away and taming that voice. Just like you would try to get your heart rate up so that you get a stronger heart, you get a stronger ability to make that voice shut up and take its place. That's one of the real big benefits. There's others, but that's one of the first core benefits that comes around from this.
Yeah, well, and I was a runner for 20 years, and I now know what you're talking about. When those endorphins kick in, you get into a zone, and when you're running, if you're running a 10K or a half marathon or something, you get to a point now where you don't hear traffic, you don't even hear the footsteps of those around you. You are just within yourself. And that, as you say, is really kind of a meditative state.
Right, right. The trouble with running, though, is that for a lot of runners, when you're not running, the voice comes back.
Right? It's telling you, put your shoes on and get outside and run.
The nice thing about this, the meditation, is that as you're focusing, the tool that you're using to control the voice and tame the voice is your own breath and your own concentration. And the nice thing about that is that you might not have your running shoes with you, but you have your breath with you everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere.
Now, is that true with something that you do, which I never really knew of, called mudding? And the closest thing that I was to mudding was when I went through basic training for the Army.
It's a few years ago, some crazy person decided that what we would do to really, challenge people is create these mud obstacle courses. And so they built these, you know, 10-mile long courses that you would run through or walk through, depending. I'm walking through now because I have two knee replacements. So I'm doing one in a month and a half, and I'm walking because the doctors were like, your running days are over with two knee replacements. And so, but I'm still doing it. And some friends and I are going with me, and we're going through all these obstacles, mud, dirt, barbed wire, electric wires. The electric wires one is a little tough,
Yeah, I would think. Because that might motivate you to move forward.
Right. Yes. You have to, on the very first tough mudder that I did, a friend had gone before me, and she said it's this wall of electricity that you run through, and they have these electrical wires dangling down. And so when she ran through it, Holly said, "Oh, it's easy." She says, they don't have a lot of wires. You just have to kind of go to the side, go this way, weave in and out. You'll be totally fine. And so I took her advice, and they were making a video. They did a video of this. I still have this video. And so I took her advice and tried to go through, but there was so many wires. They had changed the configuration. They had changed it, and there were so many wires that I could not weave and through. And so when I finally decided I had to run, I was in the midst of the wires, started to run right flat on my face, got up, took two steps forward, right flat on my face, got up the last time and made it through and fell onto my knees. And Holly, my friend, who was like, you know, you should just weave through them. When she saw the video, she said, "Oh yeah, there weren't that many wires when I went through it." I'm like, "Oh, thank you very much for that great flawless advice."
How old is the sport of mudding?
Oh, probably about 15 years old. Yeah, it's relatively. Yeah, so you see them. There's, you know, tough. A lot of places have gotten bought up.
Yeah,
because as an event, they're really difficult to run because they have to have more liability insurance than Carter's got liver pills, as my father used to say.
Did mudding start at Woodstock in 1969? I remember that scene.
Yes.
Yeah. But, and also, the more you, when you're talking about the sport of mudding, I keep thinking of the reality show, the Survivor.
It does feel a little bit like Survivor.
Because very often they are picking these obstacle type of courses and everything to challenge themselves personally and with a team.
Right. Yeah. So I'm going this year with a team of folks. And many of them are tough mudder virgins. And so they're nervous about it, they'll be fine. Some of these are more mentally intimidating than not. Like they have this year, they brought back an obstacle, and it's called Augustus Gloop, which is, if you think back, if you've ever seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, it's the big German kid that fell into the chocolate pool that got stuck in the tube.
Right.
This obstacle is these 25-foot tubes that are like this big, that's got a rope down the middle of it that you climb up. So you have to go underwater into the tube, up the rope. And while you're going up the rope to the top of the tube, they've got like a water faucet at the top that's, they're like waterboarding you while you go up to the top of the tube. But it's more mentally intimidating than actually problematic.
Folks, a lot about what we're talking about is on the website, gscottgraham.com. I invite you to drop in, take a look at it, because there's a wealth of information. And what a lot of what we've been talking about, you've you've kind of filed away in your mental Rolodex, and you've turned it into books. You've written 15 books. You're published already.
I'm working on my 18th right now. So my goal is 100 books before I die. So
I think you'll do it, because you certainly have a variety of interests to draw upon. I know you're very, very involved in landscaping and things like that. And the one book that I really want to read, just really because I'm fascinated with the name, with the title of the book, Get Off Your Ass and Mow the Grass.
I see. So, I think I have that book here. Yes. When we come back, I'll show you the book. So, there's the listings of all my books, and you can get them in print and hardcover, and they're right there on the center of the screen right now with the right. You can see, get off your ass and mow your ass. And so this is, I wrote this book because one of my biases, if you could call that, maybe it's a prejudice, is people that own post stamp sized pieces of property and have a riding lawnmower to mow that
right
postcard piece of property. And they, go around and here's the book, and they go around and sit on their riding lawnmower and drink, Mountain Dew or a milkshake or whatever, and they're not getting any exercise. And so I had a hypothesis that, you'd be better off just selling that lawnmower, mowing the grass with a push mower. That's going to burn off more calories, and you don't have to go to the gym because you're mowing the grass, which you have to do anyway. And you can take the money from selling your lawnmower and put it into personal training or health coaching. And so I wrote the book about that. It's not a big book. It's like a little baby book. You can see it's not a very thick book. I've written thicker. Here's a thick book. This one's about grief and loss. That book, and that book is, that's a smaller book. Anyway, part of that thing I did in this book is that Brian and I had a little competition. We squared off here on our 107 acres, a plot of area to mow. And he had the power mower that he sat in, and I had the push mower, and we timed it to see who could, at a regular pace, was there this big savings from having the riding lawnmower? Not at all. Not at all. It was like, 10 seconds difference. By the time, you get there, you load it up, you go to the end, you turn around, come back, put it in reverse, go that. I'm just walking up and down. There's no big time difference. So then the second piece was, is this really healthy? So I actually trained, you'll appreciate this as a runner, I trained for a half marathon, and all I did to get ready for that half marathon was mow the grass. I mowed the grass a lot,
but
I mowed my neighbor's grass.
Yeah.
but all I did was mow acres and acres and acres and acres. And I did great on that. I got a good time on the half marathon. I wrote about that in the book.
You talk about a riding mower versus a walk behind mower and all, and the physical, aspect of it. That reminds me, going back several years when the kids would go to school on these little Razor scooters, and it was great exercise. Then some yo-yo comes along and says, you know what, we're going to put a little motor on that thing. So now you don't have to push off on that scooter anymore. You just one push, get it going, and now you just glide. And now there's people that go to work on these stupid little things.
Right.
and motorized bicycles.
Yes, right, right. I'm like, that's like the epitome of crazy. Somebody who's got a bicycle with a motor on it.
Right, right.
And the purpose of the bicycle is to exercise, right? And
right.
We have this. It's the plague of America. Like, we don't, I have to be careful because I don't want to say the A-L-E-X-A word, but I can turn my TV on and change the stations with my voice. There was a time where you had to get up, turn the television, change the rabbit ears, all this other stuff. And you had really crap on television, so you're outside doing stuff. Now we've got millions of channels. Now I don't even have to reach for the remote. I can say something and poof, it's on TV.
Not only that, but if you're hungry, you can also ask that same lady to order you a pizza and have it delivered to the house.
Yes.
And when the delivery guy gets there, you can let him in the door so that he brings it directly to you.
Right. In your chair. That's Yeah.
I love it.
That's the world we become. You know, here in Vermont, one of the exercises that we do, especially here at the Rescue and the Farm, is we cut and stack wood to keep us warm in the winter. Like, there's no gym membership that's going to get you, you know, when you're like coming down, picking up the woods, setting it over there, coming down, picking up the woods, right. Setting it over there. That for a couple of hours, you're beefed up. Yeah.
It's amazing.
We've gotten lost from these activities that we used to do that used to keep us healthy. We don't do them anymore. And so then we go to the gym, right? If we don't have to go to the gym. If you just do those activities, mow your grass by yourself.
And like you said, rather than sitting in the on the couch and you've got a gas fireplace and you just push a button and it lights, you're outside chopping some wood, stacking it, rubbing a couple of sticks together, get the thing going, and then you keep feeding it.
Yeah.
I mean, if we could all just kind of go back to those early days.
Right. Where we actually vacuumed the floor and didn't have a robot do it for us. Right.
Right. And we didn't have, you know, who to just chant things to, and she would get it done. Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough, Scott, for taking the time to share some of your stories with my audience.
Privilege. It was great chatting with you, although it really was me just rambling on and on and on.
that's what made it so much fun, honestly, is because you're passionate about all of the things you do. And folks, we didn't even scratch the surface of some of the things that Scott's involved in. But visit the website and see what some of those are. Reach out, send him a note if you want. And ask him about some of the things like the rescue, or about some of the athletic events and things that he's involved in, and also about some of the things that he teaches too, from meditation to EMT training to meditation training. You're really an accomplished guy, and I may have to just reach out to you and say, hey, come on back to the show and
that would be great. Talk more. It'd be great.
So take it. From me, you're a great guy, Scott. I very, very much value you taking the time. I always end my show by saying, be yourself, because everyone else is taken. And you certainly are. And I thank you for being a part of Someone You Should Know.
Thank you.
That'll do it for another episode. Come back and see us again next week on Someone You Should Know.
Someone you should know.